hi, Vanguard. Hi.
Hi.
Vanguardistas, we salute you. It's questions, schmestions time.
Questions, schmestions.
It's my favourite thing. Rob in London. Before we get to the questions, Mark, a further twist in the Ratatouille saga.
Really? What was the dish they were eating at the end of Ratatouille?
Doctors, whilst the dish that Remy presents to Anton Ego is most certainly not pasta, it may not really be Ratatouille either.
Oh, good.
That is, I believe, a dish of vegetables braised in tomato sauce. What Remy makes is a sort of layered, slow-roasted thing. Depending on which internet foodie you ask, it's either confit Bialdi or the Provençal speciality known as a tian, T-I-A-N. Maybe I pronounced that
okay,
wrong.
Okay, so it's not ratatouille.
My guess would be that the layered veg looks better as an animated spectacle than a squishy stew with a better pun name. One thing is for certain, any non-pro attempting either at home should use a guard with their mandolin. Up with bluehead feminist, down with biological determinism, but I've never eaten a confit Bialdi or a Provençal tian. But I reckon it's supposed to be a ratatouille, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, it's. I know we've had so much shtick about this, about what was the thing that he was eating at the end of Ratatouille, that the clue is in the title. But I sort of remember spaghetti being involved in it.
I think we've already established it's not a bowl of pasta.
Yeah, I know. But what I'm doing now is here it is. Here it is. Just have a look at this, just so you can look at what the scene is, okay?
Right. So we're now watching the end of
I'm just putting it on the...
Ratatouille.
What's the name? Where's the... Oh, no, it's the fines. Where's the... Oh, you, for heaven's sake, there. You see it?
Yeah, go back to it. Pause. It looks like a sliced loaf of meat of some kind. But that's roast potato.
Okay, but
that could be a knobby version of a ratatouille.
That's the final scene. Is that... Well, that's not the scene in which Anton Ego actually does... Anyway, whatever. Well, it'll run and run.
That could be a posh... Kind
could
of
be
Ray Fiennes.
Yeah, Ray Fiennes, exactly.
Kind
yeah.
of ratatouille. Here is an email which I think will be the good lady ceramicist's favourite on the show.
Okay.
From Bernie Harper in Liverpool. PhD in perception of still and moving images and bicycle proficiency test certificate holder second class. Dear lead, bass and birdsong chorus, your joyous new klezmer sweeper keeper and intriguing questions inspired me to consider directors with influence far beyond being mere auteurs. For me, the director who has had the largest cultural impact is Steven Spielberg. In 1975, he invented the summer blockbuster, Jaws, and newly air-conditioned multiplex cinemas brought so many people back to the big screen that he effectively saved Hollywood. Close Encounters gave respectability to ufology,
yes.
That diversified into countless conspiracy genres despite many of them being patently ridiculous. Before E.T., the UK had Duck Apple Night and Fish and Chips. After E.T., we had Halloween and home-delivered pizza. Pumpkins and spooky paraphernalia appeared in every supermarket, whilst children wearing makeup and trick-or-treat costumes were seen in almost every street. Home-delivered pizza was an almost unknown thing in the UK before E.T. After it was released on home video, my brother bought a pizza delivery franchise. It was accepted at the time that the greatest advert for pizza in history was being played countless times in almost every home in the land. American-style Halloweens and pizza delivery are so entrenched now in British culture, few would believe it is a relatively new phenomenon. Spielberg showcased the genius of composer John Williams, who redefined the art of cinema score. I am sure you both can suggest many of his transformational influences. Who else even gets close to having an auteur style that binds together stories so wildly different in substance, regardless of who they were written by? And who else could we nominate to even be in the same league? George Lucas, Alfred Hitchcock, and Stanley Kubrick are amazingly influential, but they are no Steven Spielberg.
There was a point when film academia was very, very anti-Spielberg. The kind of the pendulum swung the other way to some extent. But people talked about Spielbergification of American life as being you know, in the same way that they had referred to the Disneyfication. What they meant was a way of, you know, sugarcoating everything and making it into something that was, you know, artificial. And yet what's remarkable is that when you look back at Spielberg's back catalogue, so little of that is true. And I do think that there's an interesting thing going on there as to how Spielberg was perceived and misconceived. And I was as guilty of this as the next person. And this is hence my kind of turnaround on the subject of AI and what those films are actually about. I went back and watched Duel the other day because the good lady Professor Her Indoors has been doing this Spielberg thing. And it's funny. There's so much stuff going on in the background of Duel about, very overtly talking about the crisis of masculinity in American culture. I mean, it's not just subtext, it's text. It's up there, right front and center. That darkness is there. You know, I know that the Spielberg image is the, you know, the child opening the door, the child opening the window, the light coming in. But that light, you only see the light because of the darkness around it. What a profound thing to have said.
Speaking of which, Paul Grierson is the old man, the darkest feature ever filmed. Whether it's cooking eggs, playing games with your grandson, or searching for intel on an FBI officer, everything is done in almost pitch blackness. Whilst this is clearly done to dictate the mood and to create atmosphere, following the narrative can be extremely difficult. Add to that super sharp editing, and it's sometimes difficult to know whether those on screen are getting on like a cat and dog or more like the French. My wife and I are continually asking each other what the birdsong is going on. And whilst it's an issue for both of us, we're fast approaching the age of Kermode, it's much more an issue for me that I suffer from an eye condition in which the rods of the retina are gradually burned away. Rods are responsible for vision in low light. If there is a unit of measurement for the brightness of a film, it may be of use to those of us in the low vision vault of the church. So that's from Paul Grierson. I've just seen Living, he says, which suffers from much the same issue. Low light, high contrast, but is saved by more sedate editing.
There are two points to make on this. One of them is that watching a film in cinema and watching a film at home, one of the most profound differences about it is that films that are intended to be low light in cinemas, on television, the low lightness of them can be obstructive to the point that you can't, because when you're watching something on television, you're usually not watching it in a darkened surrounding. So, for example, Ken Russell, when they did Women in Love, the fireside scene in Women in Love is actually it's shot in, you know, it's using the fine natural light to some extent. And the darkness of the image is partly because that was a way of working with the, you know, around the censorship problems, and partly because that's to do with the texture of the film. And then when you watch that in at home, if you watch it at the light level that the thing was intended to be projected at, it's like you want to go turn the light on. And so it's
but you don't want to see the Mr. Happy. So if you can't see Mr. Happy, then everyone's okay.
Yes, but it's to do with watching a darkened image in a darkened auditorium is different to watching a darkened image on a television screen. And also, of course, resolution on television screens is different to projected resolution. The way in which your eye receives the information is different. Even if you're watching an HD TV, it's not the same as looking at a projected image of light bouncing off a screen. So I understand exactly what you're saying, and it is a problem that is particularly problematic for watching stuff at home as it happens. Right. And one of the solutions is quite often to whack the brightness and contrast, which completely messes up the way the film is meant to look.
Jenny in Montreal, I haven't listened to today's episode, so apologies if you've already covered this. But now that Scorsese's Goncharov, 1973, is experiencing a resurgence in popularity, are you planning on doing a retrospective review? Says Jenny. I mean, I think...
Have you seen it?
Yeah, well, not for many years, but it might be worth revisiting. I mean, you know, it's supposed to be the best mafia film ever.
Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? It's one of those... I wonder what it looks like when you go back to it. I mean, I think Scorsese himself has, you know, his...
He was asked about it. He said he made it a long time ago. I mean, it's Robert De Niro and so on.
Yes, yeah. but okay, and the thing that nobody talks about is, yes, fine, the finest mafia movie. And what nobody mentions is that there is a moment in it in which a spaceship lands, and it's completely out of context, and everyone kind of talks about it and breezes over. And I know it's fleeting, and I know you can say, oh, "Well, okay, technically."
Because they talk about the homoerotic nature of the movie, but
yeah, but that's but okay, fine. Which is when it happens, and okay, finally, it's interstitial, or maybe it's a dream, maybe it's on set, whatever it is. There is a scene of a spaceship landing in the middle of it, and nobody talks about it.
So, Jenny, the answer to your question is almost certainly yes. From Simon in London.
Yeah.
My main gig is as a classical singer, and I also work part-time as an usher at the Royal Opera House. There's been a lot of classical music chat recently, what with this new Mozart board game, Lacrimosa, and Mark's comparison of people's approach to horror cinema and opera at the Halloween live show.
Yes.
Where he said that he just doesn't get opera. And that the difference is that with opera, no one asks, how can you possibly like that? I don't remember you saying that.
What I said was, no one says, ooh, you can't like that, it's horrible, in the same way that they do with horror films, going, oh, well, you must be a serial killer.
Well, first of all, I've had my fair share of funny looks at the mention of loving opera.
No,
but
sure.
Second, can I ask what opera Mark and Simon have tried, to which the answer will come in a moment.
Yeah.
Especially given the recent tragic news about the fantastic English National Opera being forced out of their home by government cuts. I'd like to stick up for an enormously rich vein of music with a lot of different stuff. A more apt comparison would have been opera as a whole and cinema as a whole. My first proper experience of a well-made, well-sung opera I actually liked was a life-changing experience, having been convinced that I didn't like it for about 10 years of singing in choirs before that. Sure, there are a lot of long, challenging works. Looking at you here, Wagner. You might not be catching it, but there's also some brilliantly accessible stuff in Puccini's three popular operas, Bohème, Tosca, Madame Butterfly. La Bohème is probably my all-time favourite. Eno is also a champion of getting people into opera as well as the Royal Opera House. And if he doesn't get into it soon, how will he be approaching the operatic itch, which is my story, which is becoming an opera next summer?
Yeah.
To which the answer is largely through, even before being a part of Scala, which we're both still a part of.
Yes.
I like a lot of opera at the more popular end. I've seen Marriage of Figaro twice. If you love Pavarotti, then you're going to love opera. Last summer, the summer just gone, I went to Opera Holland Park, who are the people who are putting on
Itch
next summer. And I saw Margot La Rouge, which is Delius, and I saw La Villi, which is Puccini. So I hope I've ticked a few boxes for you, Simon.
Okay, well, my experience is this. So the first opera that made any sense to me and that I loved and that I still love is Akhenaten, the Philip Glass, and my dad took me to see it, and I was absolutely blown away by it. And I've seen Akhenaten three times, and I would happily go back and watch it again because I think it's brilliant. It's one of my favourite sustained pieces of music. Wonderful. I also then went with him to see Clarissa and The Making of the Representative of Planet, whatever it was, and those were largely because they were productions that were, I suppose, film adjacent to some extent. I remember going for Newsnight Review to see that version of Parsifal, which involved the large stuffed shark hanging over the top of the stage and the guy catching the spear from behind the curtain, which I thought was ridiculous. So I've seen some, not much at all. But I would say that Akhenaten is one of the greatest live experiences. I've seen it three times and I absolutely love it.
So let's hear it for opera and opera singers and people who are threatened with having to move.
And my point was not that there's anything wrong with opera. My point was a comparison about saying you either get it or you don't. And if you don't, that's fine. But the difference is that people don't say to opera fans, ooh, you must be sick, which is what they do say to horror fans, although honestly probably less so now than they did when I was young.
Finally, Nicola Burns is asking a question. I don't think we'll know the answer to it, but it may well be that one of our Vanguard do. I have a suggestion for you, which has been vexing me for many a year. It relates to a lyric that I heard in the late 80s and early 90s.
Okay.
And the lyric is this: we'll meet one day in some celestial bar. That's the lyric.
Oh, yeah.
I very much like the idea of a heaven, which is a series of bars where you can wander in, have a drink, and talk to old friends, heroes, icons, and so on. I attributed this quote to Space, as in the female of the species is more deadlier than the male, the band Space.
Right.
But when I tried to narrow it down, I couldn't find it. No amount of Googling has turned it up. I'm now wondering if I have dreamt it. I do have very vivid dreams. Anyway, if anyone out there knows, I'd be eternally grateful. Otherwise, it was a dream. Up with good things, down with the bad. I think I'm going to hibernate until all the bad things have gone away and it's summer again. Nicola, thank you. So it is, we'll meet one day in some celestial bar.
Well, I won't Google it because Nicola's already told us that she's Googled it and she couldn't find it. It's weird that when you said it, it rang a bell, but then again, maybe that's kind of that's the false memory thing, isn't it? That you hear something that sounds like you sounds like you know it, but you don't. But
unless you're dreaming of the same song. Anyway, if anyone knows, please let us know, and send us any questions or schmestions in time for next week's program. correspondence@kermitandmayo.com. Thank you so much, and I apologise for my voice. That's when you say it's fine, Simon. People quite like it.
Oh, it's fine, Simon. Are you reading off a script now?
No. Does it sound like I'm reading from a script?
No, but when you said this, when you say that, that's usually because you're telling me off because...
I was looking for reassurance.
I just was giving you the last word.
I was looking for reassurance.
It's fine, Simon. People like it.
Thank you. That's fine.
You're so needy.
Pot. Kettle. Black. Pot.